Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. Today I'll be talking with actress Susie Damolano, producing director from San Francisco Playhouse, about her leading role in the comedy Yoga Play by playwright Deepika Guha. From Opera Parallèle, I'll talk with composer Laura Kaminsky and co-librettists Mark Campbell and Kim Reed about the world premiere of the chamber opera Today It Rains, inspired by a real event in the life of American artist Georgia O'Keeffe. It's at Z-Space, opening tonight through the Sunday. Also a talk with choreographer Deborah Slater about the 30th anniversary season of her eponymous company and the reprisal of one of its major works, The Sleep Watchers, critically acclaimed and nominated for an Isadora Duncan Dance Award following its premiere back in 2001, and inspired by the writings and research of Stanford sleep specialist Dr. William Dement. Plus, regular contributor and Open Air's critic at large, Peter Robinson, has a conversation with British San Francisco-based film critic and film historian David Thompson about his book, Sleeping with Strangers, How the Movies Shaped Desire. All that on Open Air. Stay with us. Well, it's such a pleasure to welcome back Susie Damolano to our open airwaves. Susie is co-founder with her husband, Bill English, of SF Playhouse, frequently directs productions there, and every now and again takes center stage, doing so in the current production of The Yoga Play by Deepika Guha, running through April 20th at the beautiful SF Playhouse above the Kensington Hotel lobby on Post Street. Kensington Hotel, right, Susie?
Yep, Kensington Park.
Susie's a five-time recipient of the San Francisco Bay Area Theater Critics Circle Excellence in Theater Award for Principal Actress. Maybe sixth time after this role, who knows? Most recently, she directed the beautiful production of Mary Poppins. Other directorial kudos to her for She Loves Me, Company, Into the Woods, among many others. SF Playhouse has been a pioneer in presenting not only classic plays and musicals, but by commissioning and nurturing new playwrights through their Sandbox series and Empathy Gym, offering the Bay Area significant world premieres, three of which transferred to New York. Welcome back, Susie.
Thank you so much. It's great to be back.
Well, I'm pleased to have caught the Yoga Play last week, and my first thought on hearing the title was, okay, it's going to be set in a gym, and there'll be a lot of posing going on, but definitely not the case in Deepika Guha's play, which playfully takes us inside the corporate side of yoga, and more specifically, yoga apparel.
Yes.
Give us a synopsis, if you would, with as many spoiler alerts as you care to as you care to share.
That is the difficult part, because so much of it is a spoiler. The Yoga Play is almost a play itself on words, the title. It's a play about yoga, but it's playing with yoga. And I think really the center of what it's after is to really look at that tension between enlightenment and profit. And so much of our industries and even what we are seeking ourselves is the enlightenment and living a good life, and yet we're making a lot of money off of that. So this play goes into a yoga apparel company and may have been inspired by an existing yoga apparel company.
Oh, okay. I missed that connection. All right.
There was a big brouhaha many years ago on an existing yoga company where the founder talked about its yoga pants not being see-through because something was wrong with the fabric, but the women wearing the pants. And so this sort of riffs on that comedic element and hires a female CEO since the men can't do it right. And she immediately falls into her own problems. All of which is hilarious, even though it may not sound like it's just talking about it, because of all the different topics, it just puts so many things up for grabs: appropriation, enlightenment,
Body shaming.
Body shaming, corporate America, holding, you know, breathing together, all of these things. It allows us to laugh at the things that we're constantly surrounded by.
Can we let people in on at least part of the plot revolving around different size of yoga apparel?
Yes, this company only makes up to size 8. And part of my mission as the CEO is to get them to go to size 12, which the founder of the company thinks is a plus size, but that's just a regular size. And there's a huge coup on her part to get him to say yes to size 12, because basically it brings in profits.
Exactly. It's going to bring more money, of course. We should offer at this point some kudos and namaste to Craig Marker, who plays John Dale, the cleverly video conferenced, called in granola and sandals founder of the company. Very cleverly done.
He is hilarious. And he's live every night. He's up on a video screen. So that could have been pre-recorded, but we built a green screen backstage that he's sitting in front of. And
he's at a retreat or something.
Yeah, he's at a retreat. He has his dog. He's spills things on himself. I think during rehearsal, he found a bottle of aromatherapy sitting in the rehearsal room and started sniffing it and loving it. And so he's incorporated that into his character. And I speak to him for the first 10 minutes of the play, but I'm looking into the audience and he's behind me. So he keeps developing his character and the audience keeps cracking up. And, but and I don't know what he's doing.
Oh, so you don't see him at all.
I don't see him.
You pretend to be video conferencing him, but.
Exactly. We have our stage manager's booth is on the other end, so I can see a slight reflection of him, but I don't have good enough vision to see his actual, what he's doing.
Yeah. presents some challenges and has to keep you on your toes.
Yes.
Why are they laughing so loud?
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Well, the Playhouse has produced Deepika Guha's plays in your Sandbox series.
Yeah.
And this is only the second production ever mounted of this particular play.
Yeah.
So how did that play come to you? Did you see the play? How did it come onto the series then?
I think Bill is the seeker and somehow mines all these incredible plays. And we had Deepika, two of her plays in our sandbox, and our sandbox is all world premieres. And she, I'm sure, sent us the yoga play because they were doing it at a festival down at South Coast Rep. So they did the actual world premiere. And once you read it, you can't stop laughing. So we wanted to do it, and we wanted to just put it straight up onto the main stage. And Deepika was part of the rehearsal process. She couldn't be here because she's now writing for a show down in L.A., but she Skyped in to watch rehearsals, which is so modern and right in line with what she's writing about and having everybody on video conference. And she came to opening night, and she's continuing to work on it what's great about her writing is she makes fun of people, but she does it from a place of love. So you really have an opportunity to recognize yourself, and that's what you're laughing about when you watch it. Even the John character that you talked about he's so condescending to the female CEO, and yet he's adorable and you know, and infuriating at the same time. And you laugh at that because you go, oh my God,
that's so rooted in reality.
This
yeah.
is so real.
Yeah.
It's so
yeah.
real. It's funny. You can't make this stuff up.
And when was the play written? It wasn't a date on the end.
It's only a couple of years old.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now, it's directed, in addition to having Deepika's input, it's directed by your husband, Bill English. Now, just how demanding can that tyrant of a director be? Here's your chance, Susie.
Well, you just described him perfectly. We have a rule. No notes after midnight. He's great. He is so passionate about everything that he does that he will be determined, even because the show has blackouts, if there's any peak of light somewhere, he will drive everyone crazy until that light is out. But it's all towards the cause, you know, the passion and getting the art out there and the story so that people can really grasp it and change, you know, and soak in what we have to do.
It's funny you should say that attention to detail. I remember coming to I think it was a final dress rehearsal of Company or one other thing, and the elevator, like, was moving back and forth, and I saw Bill in the corner of my eye, and his eyes were rolling. He's like,
"Oh
gotta
yeah,
fix that.
Yeah." If you want to see him really come to those final dresses, and you'll see when he sinks in his chair and he sighs audibly, and he types his notes on his computer, so you can hear the drumbeat of his fingers all the way from stage.
But he stays. That stays in the playhouse, right? It doesn't come back home with you, I hope.
No. It's good. We've gotten really good. We've been doing the theater now for 16 years, and we've been married for 20. So we've managed to figure out the way to do it and still be enthused by working with each other.
That's fantastic. And I should give a shout out to your daughter as well, Lauren. Still
involved?
Lauren?
Yeah, she's going to be directing the next show, which is Significant Other, which was a off-Broadway hit that moved to Broadway a couple years ago, and now it's coming to the Playhouse, and she's going to direct it.
Mm-hmm. We mentioned Craig Marker, who plays John Dale. Let's give another little shout out to Eilert Furstenberg, who plays the rather idealistic Ramola, as well as two other roles. Tell us a little bit about her role in the play.
She's amazing. Well, both Craig and Eilert play multiple roles. So she plays on stage a yoga instructor, and on video she plays assistants. And the great thing about Eilert is she got cast in the role of the yoga instructor. And then Bill went to her later and said, "Oh gosh, I realize you have to be in yoga silks for this. Do you mind taking some classes and we'll bring somebody in?" She said, "What are you talking about? I used to teach this." So that part, you know, it was just great synchronicity. So she's having fun up there spinning around in the yoga silks while I'm having a scene with her.
Very cleverly done. And the production, the production design.
Nina Ball is amazing. Nina Ball, and then Jackie Scott does the props for the sets. And I mean, our designers at the theater, just incomparable. They're so good. I mean, the lights with Kurt Landesman and Teddy Holsker did all the video and the sound. And it's just so great. We love working with them.
And what we love about San Francisco Playhouse, collectively, I think, as the Bay Area,
yay,
is that combination of classics and new works that are coming in. And speaking of which, the 2019-20 season has just been announced.
Yes, on
Sunday.
That
must have been a lot of wrestling back and forth and making final decisions.
It is, because there's so much great work out there, and we really do. We like to do a balance of we think of it as making the accessible edgy and the edgy accessible. And like next season, we're going to come out of the gate with a show called Dance Nation, which is just a crazy show from off-Broadway about young women, 13-year-olds, and in this dance competition. But none of them are played by 13-year-olds. It's played by women of all ages representing 13-year-olds. And that's a super edgy show. And then we're going to follow that by Groundhog Day, which was a movie, and now it's a musical. And after that, Cheryl Strayed, who wrote Wild, also wrote a book called Tiny Beautiful Things. And so there's a stage adaptation by Nia Vardalos, who did, you know, she's famous from My Big Fat Greek Wedding. And then we're going to bring Real Women Have Curves, which was a play and then a movie. And then follow that with The Clean House, which is Sarah Ruhl's breakout hit. And then we're super excited by next summer. We're doing the first professional San Francisco production of Follies.
Wow.
We can't believe that it has never been done in San Francisco, and we're the first ones to do it. Although, when I change my hat to producer, now I know why, because it's going to take about 25 people. And
that's an amazing show, and that's going to be quite an accomplishment to do on SF Playhouse.
Yeah, we're excited.
Susie Damolano, co-founder of San Francisco Playhouse, is CEO Joan in the yoga play at the Playhouse, running through April 20th, a very entertaining way to achieve at least a certain degree of enlightenment. Thanks for coming in, Susie.
My pleasure. Thank you.
sfplayhouse.org for more information. Namaste. Opera Parallel presents the world premiere performances of Today It Rains, a new opera based on a pivotal event in the life of American artist Georgia O'Keeffe, reflections during the cross-country train ride that she made and then subsequently arrived in and was wowed by the landscape and colors of her soon-to-be-beloved Santa Fe, New Mexico. It's the creation of not a dynamic duo, but a dynamic trio of creatives that created a chamber opera for two voices and string quartet called As One, which is a coming-of-age story of a transgender woman that is the most performed new opera in the country. That team being composer Laura Kaminsky, librettist Mark Campbell, and filmmaker and co-librettist Kimberly Reed. Laura's music runs the gamut from full opera, chamber, and vocal works with such intriguing titles as Catastrophe for flute, oboe, guitar, and strings, and Proverbs of Hell, to more workaday titles like Piano Trio and Whitman Songs. And she's been widely praised, recorded, and performed, including some current and upcoming productions of As One in Portland, Boise, Washington, D.C., and New York City. Welcome to you, Laura.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Happy to have you. Mark Campbell is in no doubt still all aglow from the praise being heaped on the revolution of Steve Jobs, his collaboration with composer Mason Bates, the recording of which recently received a Grammy, and which received its world premiere at Santa Fe Opera in July of 2017 and just enjoyed a run at Seattle Opera. It'll be coming to our own San Francisco Opera in June of next year. Mark was also the librettist for the Pulitzer Prize-winning opera by Kevin Putz, Silent Night, which enjoyed a glorious run recently at nearby Opera San Jose. Like Laura, also seems to be involved with some intriguing titles, such as the nefarious, immoral, but highly profitable enterprise of Mr. Burke and Mr. Hare. We'll have to talk about that, with music by Julian Grant. The 15-plus librettos he's written, and the five new operas.
It's actually up to 30
oh my
right now.
Gosh.
Yeah, that's an old bio.
Let's update that website.
It's 2 months old.
Yeah, it's 2 months.
Well, do you have more than five new operas just premiering in 2017?
There were six in 2017, but there are only two this year that are premiering.
Well, so. Nonetheless, that does demonstrate a versatility and prolificity. I maybe invented just a new word there.
It's a nice word.
Thanks. That makes him one of the most sought-after collaborators in the biz today. Welcome to you, Mark.
Thank you.
And congratulations on the continued success with my good friend Mason.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting. Yeah.
Our third element of the conversation and the creative dynamo is Kimberly Reed, an American film director and producer who is best known for her documentaries Prodigal Sons and Dark Money, which premiered at the 2018 Sundance Film Festival. She's a graduate of both UC Berkeley and SF State, and she studied film production there. She shared her own journey as a transgender woman on the Oprah Winfrey Show, and she joins us now by phone from Palm Springs. Welcome to you, Kim.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. Well, let's start with Mark. You twice replicated the train journey that forms the core of this opera, that journey that Georgia O'Keeffe made. The second time you did it with Kimberly, along for the ride, during which she did some of the filming that will appear during the opera. Tell us about those journeys.
Well, originally, Laura came up with the idea of writing an opera about Georgia O'Keeffe. And I identified this particular time in her life that was a critical juncture. She was unhappy with the New York art scene. She was having a very difficult time in her marriage with Alfred Stieglitz. And she sought a new landscape, a new emotional landscape. And in order for me to understand what that train ride was like, I took the train from New York to Santa Fe. And it's along the same tracks for one thing, but it's pretty much about the same, it takes about the same time. It's a little shorter this, now than it was in 1929. And I took it first by myself, and then the second time Kim and I took it, and Kim filmed, and we worked on the libretto together. And it was amazing. I mean, I was able to write, there was a big aria at the end of this opera where, Georgia O'Keeffe is arriving in New Mexico, and she feels the beauty and the power of this landscape. And I was able to write the first draft of that aria in this probably in the same moment she was. Of course, this is an imagined thing. She might have been looking at a magazine for all we know, or dozing,
right?
Or in a drunken stupor. Who knows? I would have been.
There must be something about that train ride that is conducive to the creative process as well. You're not. It's not the speed of, and the confines of an airplane or a car ride.
Precisely. One of the reasons I chose to put this opera on a train ride, I mean, it starts at Penn Station in New York and ends in New Mexico at Lamy, which is a town outside of Santa Fe, was because a train ride induces memories. You're lurching forward on a destiny, on a journey, but you're also able to contemplate your past. And so it's not that we are stuck on this train, you know, for 3 days or anything like that. The opera is 80 minutes long. But we go back and forth in time. And one thing that's been so exciting about working with Opera Parallel is that our director, Brian, and our conductor, Nicole, have been involved in the collaborative process at the beginning. And so Brian has devised this brilliant set where the train just breaks up at certain moments. And suddenly we're in the apartment that Stieglitz and O'Keefe shared in New York. And suddenly we're back in the gallery, 291 Gallery, where Stieglitz showed O'Keefe's work. And we're back in Wisconsin. And this has been really captured brilliantly by Laura's score.
I should mention that the creative trio is really a creative quintet.
Well, we call it a thruple at this point.
As you mentioned, conductor Nicole Paimont and her partner and collaborator on many productions, creative director Brian Stauffenbeel. So when did the full team first assemble? Laura Kaminsky perhaps can take that.
I think it actually sort of got born here in San Francisco when Brian and Nicole came to see West Edge Opera's production of As One. And they came up to speak with us afterwards, and they were taken with and said, you know, maybe we could do something together one day. And at that point, we have just completed As One a year ago and knew that the three of us wanted to continue working together. So I had sent Mark and Kim this, do you think you could do something on O'Keefe? And so we were beginning to address this as a possible topic. So I had an opportunity to meet with Nicole in Washington, D.C. at the Opera America conference. And I told her that we were thinking about this, and she loved it because O'Keefe is such an iconic figure in American art. She's a powerful woman. There's this historic, exciting period in which this story takes place that's got so many rich musical and visual images that we could all latch on to. And
also Opera Parallel has a history of creating works that meld music, story, and visual design. And it's the perfect match for this opera. And, you know, we should probably talk to Kim about the visual design, because that's the third part of this story.
And it was part of the original conception
that sure.
There would be that visual, which is part of what excited Brian and Nicole and I guess
Kim,
too.
Yeah, from some of our first conversations where Mark and I were conceiving the libretto together, we wanted to leave as much space as we could for the visuals, for film that would play out in conjunction with music. So as librettists, we wanted to not write words.
I was only too happy to do that.
Yeah, you got off easy, right?
I know, right? Let's just add an interlude. Yeah.
And it may sound a little pretentious, but we thought of them as visual arias where we would just let the visuals take over. And Laura, who's actually a very visual composer, and I think a lot of times this, I've noticed, has to find a visual way into the music that she's writing, and it needs to be inspired by these images. The images that I had been collecting and sharing with Laura, and of course George O'Keefe's inspiring lexicon of imagery, if I can phrase it that way, were two things that really came together, I think, to inform Laura's music. So as somebody else said, having Opera Parallel involved so early on and such an integral part of conceiving this piece, I think has allowed these different components of the piece, the music and the words and the visuals, to really commingle in a way that sometimes doesn't happen.
Yeah, if I could add to that, one of the things that was really different about this project for the three of us was having the director involved from the very beginning, because Brian would say, well, after he received the libretto from Mark and Kim, he said, well, you know, after this scene, we're going to have to break apart the train and it's going to become the gallery. So, Laura, while you're writing the score, you're going to need to think about 25 to 35 seconds so I can move all these parts around.
Oh, terrific. So that's built into the process.
So it wasn't like, okay, let's hold this chord while the next thing happens. It was like, okay, I have to create movement through sound that allows the sets to move and the next scene to appear because it's seamless throughout. Mm.
I think that's important for people to understand, too, that it's not just a matter of, boom, here's the libretto, you set it to music, and then it'll be directed. And it's such an interesting collaborative process that's going on here. And also in the way that I understand, Laura, that the way the music was created, tell us about that, and that some of the music was set to Kim's film and vice versa.
Well, I haven't actually seen the full film. Kim? Kim, what are you doing in Palm Springs
get
today?
Get out of Palm Springs and get home and work.
I think that's a hint. That sounds like a hint.
What we did was we mapped out what the imagery was going to be, and some of it I've seen bits of material, but I haven't seen it because Kim is actually going to be now cutting to the music. So it's really interesting that her image language informed my music, but then my music is going to inform how she puts those images together to make the actual
film. So it becomes visual choreography then.
Yeah, it really is.
Cool. Yeah.
There's this one scene, which is the big visual aria, which is called Scene 5. Very original title. but basically, it's when Georgia's just in that dream state on the train, and her mind is wandering back and forth through her life. And so it's a little bit of her biographical revelation for the audience, but there's nothing spoken or sung. It's all going to be done through the images that Kim is creating. And so we mapped out together, the three of us, Mark and Kim and I, what pieces of her life do we want to in some way evoke through sound and image that aren't part of the sung story? Mm. And so,
and you're all involved in that. That's what's so wonderful about this.
Yeah, I wish they'd write some of the notes.
We'll do that next.
Good.
We could never write them as good as you.
Yes,
so.
You could.
Well, inevitably, the gestation process of a work like that, scenes must be cut or added. Any heartbreak involved with that, or some wrestling arguments, or was everyone pretty much on the same page, so to speak?
No, you're never on the same page, but you hope that you're on the same plane as far as creating.
You mean train?
Yeah, I meant PL. Yeah, okay, or boat, whatever your mode of transportation is. That we all arrive at the same place. That our vision is aligned, and sometimes that means that you have to argue and you know get through something. We worked really closely on this piece, and also with Brian and with American Opera Projects, who is a co-producer on this piece in New York. And there was this big moment at the end that they gave us three workshops and we still never got right. And it was a matter of kind of going back to the text and saying, how can I help Laura get to this moment? And so there were like times when I had to add stuff and whatever, but it was a great collaboration ultimately.
Well, it sounds like it's all working out rather well, though, and I'm looking forward to seeing the production. Could you talk to us a little bit about the cast?
Mark
Campbell. Go ahead.
It's a chamber opera, and so the cast is actually very small. There are only four principal characters, and there's an ensemble of four singers. We have, of course, Georgia O'Keeffe, and she was traveling with Beck, Rebecca Strand, a fellow artist and good friend, and possibly lovers later after they arrived in Santa Fe. And then Stieglitz is in the cast as well, but of course he's not on the train with them. He's back home in New York and also in her memory. And then the fourth character, because we needed to have a character that's in the present with Georgia so that she has a connection with someone who's actually on the train, is a porter named Aubrey Wells. And they form a friendship on the train ride. It's a three-day train ride. And as you know, when you travel with people, you often form very meaningful connections that may continue or end when you get to your destination. Aubrey gives her some good advice that helps her move forward on her journey.
Interesting.
Yeah, I think what made Aubrey so powerful in this piece is that he, as a character, is a porter, but he's actually a serious musician. And he sees in her that she's kind of struggling with something, and she sees in him somebody who's questing. And so they have a connection around following your true self and being able to make your art. And so it's a really beautiful construction that Mark and Kim came up with by inventing Aubrey.
Mm-hmm. And were you all involved in the casting process?
Somewhat. They involved us. I mean, opera companies don't necessarily involve you in the casting process. Sometimes you're handed a cast. In this case, they did check with us. They made great suggestions. I mean, we have Marty Breckenridge, who lives in San Francisco, she's amazing as Beck. And Blythe Gaisert, we've worked with many times. She's done As One. I've worked with Danny Belcher many times. He's done Silent Night and a few operas, and they're really terrific. And the Nathan playing Aubrey I have not worked with him yet. But
mm-hmm. What's really been great is just there's been a real commitment on the part of the principals and the ensemble of four to build a family to make this piece come to life. So it's been a lot of fun in the rehearsal process.
Mm-hmm. That might change tomorrow. We don't know.
Composer Laura Kaminsky, tell us then, being a chamber, it's being thought of as a chamber opera, how did that affect your orchestration?
Well, I had to choose because I couldn't have every possible instrument. So I wanted to create different kinds of sound worlds and different configurations of instruments for different characters and different parts because I needed trained music. I needed motion. I wanted Aubrey, who we decided would be a clarinetist, so I needed a clarinet that would really be facile, who could play both jazz-like playing as well as classical playing in a soloistic realm.
I was going to talk about the styles involved as well. Then.
A lot of different styles. There's a big percussion section, and percussion is used to evoke a lot of different sound worlds and different kinds of energies throughout the piece. There's some different winds, and it's a nice and interesting. It's funny because when we were talking about the orchestration, Nicole kept saying, "I think you should use a French horn," and I kept thinking, "Why does she want a French horn?" And then I realized it's her French heritage. It just must be in her ear. But it works really well. It's sort of a signaler, and of course, Alfred Stieglitz was American-born but came from German Jewish heritage, and listened to a lot of German romantic music. So I thought the horn was good. There's a little bit of playing with bits of music from that to evoke him. There's some late 1920s fragments of jazz mm-hmm. that I used, four or five notes to then create Aubrey's theme.
So a lot of homework involved and applied to the work. That's
in the film Scene 5, the biographical film with the just music and no words, there's looking back through her life, and her father used to play Irish fiddle music to her when she was a child, so there's a whole bit of that. So there's a lot of different sound worlds to convey urban modernism and the big open landscape throughout the piece. Mm.
I should also mention that there's a variety of fun and inspiring public events, including artist talks, book signings, food and drink, a special lobby installation, and more between March 27th and 31st at Z-Space. Taking Georgia and the Rebels as its theme, the performances and events will celebrate some of the Bay Area's own creative rebels inspired by the spirit of Georgia O'Keeffe. World premiere performances will be given Thursday, March 28th through the Sunday, the 31st, at Z-Space on Florida Street in San Francisco. Throughout the four performances and 5 days of events, Opera Parallel will honor women who, like O'Keeffe, break the mold, defy expectations, and have been pushing the boundaries of their fields. A complete schedule may be found at operaparallel.org. Also for more tickets and information. Still to come on Open Air for this week, a conversation with Peter Robinson and film historian David Thompson about his book Sleeping with Strangers, How the Movies Shaped Desire. Good afternoon. Once again, I'm David LaTulipe, and you're listening to Open Air on KLW. Deborah Slater Dance Theater's 30th season launches with the reprisal of one of its major works, The Sleep Watchers. Originally inspired by the writings and research of Stanford sleep specialist Dr. William Dement, and newly reworked and recast, The Sleep Watchers looks at sleep metaphorically and literally, examining how it affects society's mental and physical well-being. The Sleep Watchers runs for three performances only, tonight, Friday, and Saturday at 8 p.m. at ODC Theater here in San Francisco. And here to talk about the production is the eponymous director and founder of Deborah Slater Dance Theater, Deborah Slater. Deborah is an award-winning dancer, director, choreographer, and has been working in theater and dance for some 30 years. Among her collaborations, the Magic Theater, San Diego Rep, and Traveling Jewish Theater. Welcome, Deborah Slater, to Open Air.
Thank you very much.
Wow, 30 years of Deborah Slater dance. Congratulations.
Thank you. It's shocking.
Well, tell us how it all started and the mission statement, so to speak, of Deborah Slater dance.
Well, over the course of making work and becoming a creative artist, I realized that one of the things I was doing was understanding life and life experiences, and that the process of thinking through a show and doing research always came around to things that people were experiencing in their lives and how we dealt with it. And this piece was one of those also.
So this is probably one of the reasons why this, having premiered in 2001, this is the work that you chose to bring back for your 30th anniversary.
One of the things about this piece that I really liked was that it has a really serious basis, but it's also very funny. There's a lot of really interesting things that you can do with dreams and sleep.
I'm sure.
And my brother is a sleep doctor, and he was the one who started me down this path because he started telling me some of the really odd stories of what people do when they're asleep.
So he must have been familiar with Dr. William Demington.
Yeah, he was the one who told me that he was at Stanford and made the connection. Mm-hmm.
Apparently 90 years old now, still on the Stanford faculty list.
Yes, he's coming, too. He's coming. He came to the show the first time with his family. And when I called, I didn't know if I'd get a hold of him. And I got a note back from his daughter saying, oh, yes, he remembers the show. We'll be there. So he's coming, and he's bringing other members of his staff. It's mm-hmm. very exciting.
So tell us some of the stories that your brother then got you interested in trying to incorporate into your dances.
One of the most memorable is that an entire family would get up, and they'd all convene at the kitchen table. They'd eat, and then they'd go back to bed, and they wouldn't remember. And they were all gaining weight, and they couldn't figure out why.
And was it discovered that there was some pharmaceutical connection with this? Or?
No. It was just some strange thing about what they do as like sleepwalkers and people who do that kind of thing. It just was this odd thing that went through the whole family.
Hmm. Well, it's being called newly reworked and recast. I can understand the recasting since it's been since 2001, but how have you reconceived it or reworked it?
Well, one of the things that happens is I build my pieces really collaboratively, so the actual movement in the piece was built on the original dancers, and I have a different crew, and they have different sets of skills, so we're taking the skills that they have and incorporating it into the piece. So some of the basic shape of the piece is the same, the structure is the same. Much of the movement is the same, but then when we needed to adapt things or somebody had talents, like I have a young kid who's a hip-hop dancer, and he's bringing a whole other character that I didn't have before.
Mm-hmm. And you have, obviously, 30 years ago, you didn't have the beautiful ODC Dance Theater. Where was the premiere 30 years
actually,
ago?
Actually, it premiered at Dance Mission, and then I brought it back a year later to ODC. So we're back in the space, but not in the state. It's now transformed and is a new, beautiful theater.
Mm, it really is. Tell us about the music by David Allen Jr.
David is a composer. He has a business called Leather Sacks Music, and he has worked at Grace Cathedral running their music program, and now he is a musical director at Beach Blanket Babylon. But he does all kinds of music, and he's a really good player himself, too.
Nice. Well, you mentioned you have a hip-hop dancer who's bringing his skills to the equation. What else will we actually see on stage?
Well, one of the things that drives the piece is we did many, many interviews with people to find out what they dreamed about and what their sleep issues were. And a recurrent thing that came up over and over was that people use their dreams to try and reconcile relationships with people that they've lost, to try and somehow understand these experiences. And we put a couple of them together. And so the underlying story that drives it is, in this case now, the casting is a woman and a man. But it's a woman who's in her 40s, and she can't sleep. And she comes to a sleep clinic to find out why and to see if they can help her. And she keeps dreaming about her brother, who died when they were very young. And she was around when the death happened, and she thinks she caused it. And in her sleep, she's always trying to understand what happened and talk to him about it.
Interesting.
And he comes back to tell her it's not her fault.
It's funny. You know, last night I had several bizarre, wonderful dreams, and just very vivid. I wonder if it was in anticipation of my talk with you today.
Maybe so.
I think everyone is fascinated with dreams. I mean, from early on in elementary school, when kids are asked to write an essay about something, it's, you know, they want to study dreams because it's one of the most lack of understanding. I don't say misunderstood, but just why.
And even in the science world, they're still. At the time when this was created, the thought, there was an argument on the furthest extreme that it was junk in, junk out. And now they really think that you can learn things if you think about them before you go to sleep, that your mind sorts stuff. And the conclusion that they've come to is that our waking life prepares us for our sleeping life, and that our brains are very, very active when we're asleep, and that we don't go to sleep. We're putting the pieces together. That we've been assembling all day long. We gather all the information in the daytime, and the nighttime is when it all knits together.
Interesting. Yeah. I'll have to look up some more work of Dr. Dement then.
Yeah, he's quite an amazing guy.
Well, you've got just about the most appropriate sponsor in the form of McCroskey Mattress Company. How did that association start?
Well, a friend of mine kept saying, there's this mattress store, and they have these wonderful windows with beds in them. Maybe they'd let you do a photo shoot in there. And I called them up. And it turned out they're the nicest people. Robin McCroskey Acevedo is the daughter of one of the McCroskey brothers, and they came to the show also. I met him when he was still alive, and they let us do a benefit in their store, and we literally, I came in and said, well, can we get on the furniture? And she said, oh, yeah, you can't hurt our furniture. And so we had dancers jumping on the beds, and, I mean, people were going by the windows and stopping to look at the dancers jumping on the beds. And I called up Robin, and I said, we're going to do this piece again. Would you like to participate in it somehow? And she gave us a bed frame that we're using in the piece that the dancers are jumping all over, and they have just been wonderful.
Well, let's put in a local plug for McCroskey Mattresses on a longtime local business, 1687 Market Street. They've got a third floor that is now used for events such as the San Francisco Silent Film Festival, book readings put on by the Green Arcade, and mini concerts by students from the San Francisco Conservatory of Music, and dancers jumping up and down on mattresses occasionally.
It's a gorgeous building, and the story behind it's really interesting because McCroskey's wife was working as a secretary back in, I don't know, the 20s or something, and she saved the money and bought the building for her husband to make this factory. And the two brothers had a falling out, and one started another business that failed, and this one succeeded.
Wow. You're also involved with the San Francisco International Arts Festival in late May and early June.
And that's going to be a whole different show. One of my insane choices was to decide to do as much as I could in this year. And so I'm bringing back all the solos that I've performed, many of which I've given to other people, but some have never been given to anyone else. So it'll be an evening of solos that I did throughout my career while I was performing.
And before that, please take an effort to see Deborah Slater Dance Theater this weekend, tonight, Friday and Saturday at 8 at ODC Theater, 17th Street here in San Francisco. The reimagining, redreaming of the Sleepwatchers from 2001. DeborahSlater.org for more information. ODC.dance also. Deborah, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you very
much.
Thank you. And all your charms, whenever I want you, all I have to do is dream.
Well, we've gone from dreaming with the Everly Brothers to spooky music. And that, of course, is our introduction to our guest today, David Thompson. His book, Sleeping with Strangers, No Longer Sleepwalking, Sleeping with Strangers, a wonderful memoir, an encyclopedic history of Hollywood in the 20th and early 21st century, part psychology, and in many ways a critical history. David, welcome to KLW.
Thank you for having me.
So, just hearing that little bit of Hitchcockian soundtrack, why don't we start off by talking about Hitchcock and where you put him in terms of movie history?
Well, for me, partly because we're both English originally, he's the crucial figure. And I would say that in the time when I was teaching film, Hitchcock was the most inviting filmmaker to teach, because he was making choices all the time, very particular, very special, pointed choices. So you can't look at a moment from a Hitchcock film without getting into the nature of the medium. Now, that's a sort of technical thing. I love him. I'm afraid of him, I'm bound to say, because he frightened me in the movies a lot. But that music from Vertigo is really emblematic of something I think is important to him, in which the suspense of mystery, who did it, what was done, who is she, it's a very sexual, erotic thing in Hitchcock. Hitchcock was not in any way a glamorous, attractive man. But the more we know about him personally, biographically, the clearer it is, I think, that he was obsessed with eroticism and voyeurism. Mm-hmm. And he really made films that, I think, define the voyeuristic nature of the medium, the way in which we are asked to look at other people from the privileged dark.
And I think this is true in Rear Window in particular.
Rear Window is the model film, because it's a film in which a man who has taken sensational pictures all his life is laid up by an injury, and he looks out of his window at a courtyard, a model of the rest of the world, really, and he can't look without imagining stories. Mm-hmm. As it happens, the story he imagines proves to be true. But it's a model for the way Hitchcock always says to us, look closely. What's behind what you're seeing?
And, of course, we should add the man is, of course, Jimmy Stewart. And
yes.
Inside the apartment is Grace Kelly. So he could go inside or outside and find a good story, in fact.
And find a great actress, too. I mean, Hitchcock operated almost entirely within the age of censorship, where what you could do on screen, what you could say, how naked people could be, these things were very carefully restricted. But within that framework, he was superb at finding actors and actresses for whom you could imagine what they might do in private. And Grace Kelly, who made three films with him, she's really, I think, the essential Hitchcock actress. Very cool, very ladylike. Mm-hmm. She doesn't really do anything outside the normal range, but you feel she could do almost anything you could imagine. That's what Hitchcock is about.
And she did outside the screen.
Well, I'm told. Yes.
Now, let's focus just for a second, because to compete with television, when they were shooting Rear Window, they actually had to use 3D at one point.
Yes, well, you know, Rear Window comes at the time when the movie business is actually cracking under the pressure of television. Television had taken the audience in such a big way, and in the 50s, with 3D and CinemaScope, Cinerama, there were a lot of attempts to say, look, the movies can do things that television can't do. Mm-hmm. It was a forlorn process, because the logic of people staying at home to watch the small screen was clear. We know today just how thoroughly it has taken over, because you can't really talk about movies anymore, because people stream on screens that are so small I can hardly see them. Mm-hmm. That's where the action is. And you could see that battle being fought and lost by the movies in the 50s. But that said, Rear Window is one of the great, great films about the whole process of watching and wondering.
Now, you're going to be speaking about your book at Book Passage this evening
at
7 o'clock. And I think because you've written many earlier books and you've seen how authors relate to readers, yeah, we have sadly seen the diminishing number of bookstores. So I'm interested, when an author goes into a bookstore, whether they're thinking about the difference between the spoken word and the written word.
It's amazing. You really have to transform yourself as an author. You have sat in solitude probably for years writing the book, rewriting, puzzling over the words, and then all of a sudden you get out there in the world and you will have an audience. And you read to them, you talk to them. I sometimes show clips from movies. I will do that tonight. You become a performer. You have to learn how to perform your book. And I would say that I couldn't do it with any kind of proficiency if I had not been a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
Because for me, having led as a writer a very solitary life, teaching, which I was plunged into at a certain age when I'd never expected it, it terrified me, but it really taught me that I had to act out what I was thinking and saying.
Yeah, and it's not unlike radio. Radio is the theater of the mind. You have to create pictures, and I think an author in a bookstore has to do that.
Well, you know, you and I are of about the same age, and we're from England, and I would say, though I went to the movies a great deal when I was very young, radio, for me, was the crucial formative medium growing up, listening to the BBC.
Mm-hmm.
Hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe it was for you,
absolutely.
Too.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yes.
In fact, I remember the BBC News on the radio. They would still wear dinner jackets and black bow ties.
That's right.
to read
right.
The news. So the publisher wanted you to explore the influence of gay actors, gay directors, gay costumers, set designers, as the sort of subtext to the book. Is
right,
it?
Yeah. And that was a very interesting way to go, because show business has always had a lot of gay people, and the movies certainly had many, many of them. And the more I looked at it, the more I thought about it, the more I came to the conclusion that the movies had had a very big influence on the way society as a whole looks at gender and sexuality. Don't forget, it's a medium that says, if you're a man, oh, look at that woman, isn't she beautiful, isn't she desirable? But at the same time, it's saying, look at that man, wouldn't you like to look as good as he does? When you look at Rear Window, if you're a guy, you're turned on by Grace Kelly. Sure, that's obvious. But you're turned on by Jimmy Stewart, too. And I know when I saw the film, I'd never been to America at that time, I sort of taught myself to talk like Jimmy Stewart.
With a stutter?
I had a stutter anyway. Okay. I was ahead of the game. When Rear Window Rebel Without a Cause came out the year after Rear Window, I got a red windbreaker like James Dean had, and I tried to comb my hair in that way. In other words, there's a way in which men aspire to be the man in a movie as much as they aspire to having the woman in a movie. And, of course, it works the other way around. So it was a medium that taught us about the beauty in the opposite sex, but in our own sex, too. Male grace in the movies, I think, has had a great deal to do with the way society as a whole has become much more accepting of gay lifestyles.
Mm-hmm. And now, I just want to pick up on that phrase, male grace, because at the moment, with the Me Too movement,
yes,
male grace may be hard to find.
Well, there's male grace on screen.
Mm-hmm.
What we've learned in the Me Too movement, or what the public has learned, something anybody in the movies knew for a long time, was that in the making of movies, in the business, the industry, women were appallingly exploited by men. As a matter of course, Harvey Weinstein is now the famous sinner, and he may yet end up in prison because of it. I have to tell you that anybody who worked for him knew approximately what was going on for years. They knew that he was screwing people financially for years, and they did nothing about it because in the nature of that business, what Weinstein did, and don't take this away from his reputation, he made a ton of very good, interesting, daring movies that would not have been made without him. And that has always been the way in which people who run the movie business get away with behaving so badly. They say, you want to make a movie?
Yeah, the legacy is more important than the individual.
Absolutely. Yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
Now, this evening, when you're at Book Passage, you said you may use some clips.
Yes.
So what particular clips have you opted for?
I'm going to show the opening of Bonnie and Clyde, a remarkable film in which sexuality and violence are sort of hand in glove the whole time. But I'm going to use it as a way of just showing how the movies say to us, look how wonderful people can be. Both Bonnie and Clyde are deeply sexually attractive in that film.
Mm-hmm. And will there be other clips you'll have as well?
No, I'm going to show the opening section from Bonnie and Clyde.
Mm-hmm. And just to finish with, you do include a reference to what I call buddy movies, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Right.
And I often see that more as a story of the 60s, people defying the law, than anything else, and maybe a hint of a menage a trois with Catherine Ross.
Sure. Yeah. Well, the buddy system on screen, I think, is absolutely remarkable. Men were used to seeing films about male friendship in which the men lived together and there was hardly ever a woman in sight. Mm-hmm. And for decades, we didn't investigate it. We didn't think about it. You look at Laurel and Hardy, say, now, who for me are one of the classic buddy pairings, and you see their affection and you see how far they can't really tolerate femininity. They have everything. They're a married couple, and you know that is something that pervades the history of the movies, that formula.
Well, again, I want to thank you, David Thompson, for coming in. This evening, David will be at Book Passage in Corte Madeira, 7 o'clock, talking about his new book, Sleeping with Strangers. If you want to find out who those strangers are and what the sleeping means, come tonight to Book Passage at 7 p.m. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
In with Hitchcock, out with Hitchcock, and music from the great Bernard Herrmann from Marnie. That's Open Air for this week. An invitation for you to catch a wonderful performance by the San Francisco Symphony Chorus and Orchestra on Saturday. Ragnar Bolin will conduct the forces of the symphony, the chorus, the amateur music network, as well as Voices of Music and Early Music Ensemble in Johann Sebastian Bach's masterpiece, The St. John Passion. That's Saturday at 8, sfsymphony.org for more information. I'm David Latulippe. You've been listening to Open Air here on Local Public Radio, KALW San Francisco. My thanks to Neil Swinkles for producing the show. The shows are archived at kalw.org. Show suggestions, admonitions, praise, I'll take it all. David at kalw.org. Thanks for listening.